Daily Beast editor-at-large and author Goldie Taylor has had a distinguished career as a print and television journalist and as a public policy analyst. She grew up in the St. Louis area, and she was sexually abused as a child here and has some thoughts on the abuse issue in the presidential campaign. She'll join civil rights icon Morris Dees as part of the St. Louis Speakers Series panel on race relations this evening. Dees was our guest on this program yesterday. I began a phone interview with her, as I did with him, asking her view of race relations in today's America.
You know, I think that, you know, maybe I'm the optimist here, but I think we are better off than our popular media seems to suggest, than we see on social media or on cable news. I think that so many of us know one another as neighbors, as friends, as coworkers. And I think in that regard that I think as President Obama used to say, we're not as divided as our politics seem to suggest. That doesn't say that there aren't very real problems in this country. There are. And there are some very real and wide divisions on some very key issues that, you know, really do keep coming up. You know, unfortunately, we still have a great divide between law enforcement agencies and the communities that they're sworn to serve and protect. We still have huge divides around immigration and entitlement reform. We still have very, I think, real divides on equal pay for men and women in the workplace. And now we've seen in these recent days around what constitutes sexual harassment. And so there are some very real issues. But taken in its totality, I wouldn't want to live any other place on earth. I think that we are much better off, much stronger than our politics sometimes suggest.
Well, what you're suggesting, that a big reason for the divide that exists today is the current political climate.
It is, absolutely. And a current political climate that has been, without question, ignited, accelerated, I don't know what the word is here, magnified, maybe that's the best word for it, magnified by how we consume and how media tends to out-report this news. And so when you look at cable news, when you look at social media, when you look at, you know, how the currency of media is made, chasing fire to fire, I think that some of this is a creature of our own consumption. You know, when I was a kid, Don, watching you on TV, as a matter of fact, and running around the streets in East St. Louis, whenever a fire truck came roaring down State Street, we kids would go chasing after the fire truck because we wanted to see what was on fire. And believe you and me, there was something always on fire in East St. Louis. Well, the same is true for us grown-ups today. We seem to chase those fires down the street. And so when Donald Trump is on cable news saying some other bombastic thing, or if Hillary Clinton is sitting before Congress and they wanted to find out what's in her emails, you know, we seem to chase this stuff fire to fire. And I don't think it really serves us, to tell you the truth. I don't think it serves us to chase the fire truck down the street.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I mean, you're a past veteran of various cable networks. We're all part of the media, and yet we are among those who are most critical of the media. Yet we're a part of it.
We are. We are absolutely a part of it. And I think that after this election is over, I think that all of us, one and all, collectively, we're going to have to take a really hard look at what we understand our role to be, what our responsibility is to this republic. You know, we have a great right afforded to us under this Constitution, this free press, and does that not leave us with some obligations to this fabric? I think it does. And I think that in so many ways, unlike so many other cycles, you know, that we've let us down. And it's hard to say that now, knowing that I have so many colleagues across this country, not only on the national networks, but big city newspapers across the country, at local radio stations, you know, people just out doing the best darn work that they can turn in. I have so much respect for them, but I also know what consumes the most air, what gets the most oxygen. And all too often, it tends to be the more inflammatory. And it tends to be the stuff that really divides us rather than the stuff that should be bringing us together.
Let me give you my take on something with regard to that. And that is that
sure.
Clearly we know the political bent of cable networks like MSNBC and Fox, to name the
yes.
two most extreme. And yet they have fairly large followings, but the people who watch one or the other don't watch the other. People go where
That's
they're
right.
most comfortable, so they have no exposure to other points of view.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I think that's where some of the problem lies. You know, Pew did a study some years ago about, you know, how our ideological perspective really informed what we consumed whether it be, you know, cable news or newspaper, what we believe, what we want to take in every day. And so part of it, you know, while I will say, yes, part of it is about us and our colleagues and how what we decide to report, part of it is what the consumer at home wants to get out of it. Do they want that kind of confirmation bias that sometimes news outlets are so invested in giving? And so I think that makes it difficult. This really is, you know, a multilateral conversation. You know, when I was coming up, there was one guy, it was always a guy, always a white male, you know, on your 6 o'clock news, telling you what the news was of the day, and there was no feedback other than sort of these letters to the editors that sometimes got read at the end of the newscast. They don't do that anymore. I wish they did. But now there's this conversation that, you know, when Chuck Todd does Meet the Press, he can immediately look to Twitter and see thousands of people giving him feedback in real time. And I think that some stock has to be placed, I think, really in that conversation, that, you know, we become responsive, that we get outside of the studio and talk to real people and how they're thinking and feeling, whether it's about an election or about, you know, closing of a grocery store or a Little League game, whatever the news happens to be. I think so many newsrooms are so pressed for resources that the reporters rarely leave the building anymore. Yeah. I think it's time to get back to that.
I guess it could be argued, though, Goldie, that the people who are sending out those tweets are real people.
They are. They are, but they tend to overrepresent, I think, what you get. It's sort of like Republican or Democratic presidential primaries. You get the most ardent voters. You get the most fiery grassroots of folks. I think those tweets are also the most fiery and vested of us, that our voices are louder than some others. And I'm guilty of this because I'm on Twitter and Facebook all the time. You know, I've got a good many followers, and we're in constant conversation. But I shouldn't let that keep me from talking to my neighbor, or getting to know the woman who leads the PT at my local elementary school, you know, getting to know the shopkeeper on the corner who makes my pastrami sandwich, and, you know, maybe I should know his first name and what he thinks about all of this stuff. You know, I just think that sometimes it keeps us from getting to know one another. And people get to say all kinds of things from anonymous accounts, things they wouldn't dare say to you if you were to meet them on the street. And so I hope that there is a bit of a correction. I think social media is awfully important. I have used it on a number of occasions, as you know, to get out any number of stories. But I think that we can't allow that going forward to take the place of real conversation and real engagement with people.
It's still a baby. We're still learning how to use it, aren't we?
Yes, we sure are. We sure are.
Goldie, there was something else I wanted to bring up, and I'm sure it's painful for you, but I know you've gone public on it on many occasions, and that is your own experience with assault as a young woman. What in the world are you making and thinking in view of what's been going on for the last 10 days or so?
You know, well, it's been difficult, to say the least. I think it sort of took the breath out of me when I heard women on social media, as a matter of fact, talking about how long it took them to talk about being sexually assaulted. One woman said 5 years, another said 3, another said 20, another said 30. It wasn't until a woman said to me that she was 70 years old, that it had happened 50 years ago, and she had only now begun to talk about it. And, you know, for the first time, I almost felt like I wasn't alone anymore, that I had waited almost 3 decades. It's now been 3 decades. It's been 32 years now, that I had waited a very long time to talk about the man who I said sexually abused me, and to talk about molestation in our family unit, you know, among cousins and neighbors and such. The first time that I had begun to really speak it out loud, and it was the first time that I really believed that there was power in the words, I am a rape survivor. I never wanted that label. I never wanted to be a part of that kind of a community, I had said to myself. But today I see real power in those words, that it means that I'm an ally to anyone else who's been victimized, that sometimes I need to be an ally even to myself. And so in speaking publicly about it, I almost had to numb my own pain, because my pain is still very fresh and real for me.
What caused you to go public with it after 30 years?
I wanted other people to know that it was okay. I wanted other men, other women, other children who had been abused to know that it was okay to speak out. That I wanted to provide some safe harbor if there was 1, 2, 3, 10 people across the country who could step forward and say, this happened to me and it was wrong. then that would be the payoff for me, that someone else was able to get the help that I wasn't able to get when I was a child.
In a sense, these women that the 8 or 9 women who have come forward in the last week or so, are maybe they're being victimized again because basically they're all being called liars.
Well, you know, and that's why we don't talk out so early. And the average time, by the way, for, you know, a victim of sexual violence to speak out is around 30 years. And I think it takes us that long because we are afraid of being re-victimized, that we are being afraid, even if there is never a trial, which typically there is not. Only a fraction of sexual assault survivors ever see their cases go to court and ever see someone be convicted or go to jail for this. But when it does go to court, there is that shame and blame that I was culpable in the violence against me. And nobody wants to be on trial for that, whether inside of a courtroom or out. I remember when I first came forward in 2011 about what had happened to me, there were strangers on the street who told me I should be ashamed of myself. One man on a flight, I will never forget his face, on the flight from Atlanta to St. Louis, we were sitting next to each other and said, I'd gotten lucky and been upgraded to first class, but unluckily sat next to this man who said, I know who you are, and you should be ashamed of yourself. And that keeps people from coming forward. But for every man in first class that I happen to be upgraded and sit next to, I want there to be a Goldie Taylor to be able to put my hand on your knee and say, it's okay. It's okay. No, you shouldn't be ashamed of yourself.
What do you think the impact of all of this is likely to have on the election?
Well, I think the election for Donald Trump was probably lost before this all began, if we look at how the polls were trending. And that was for any number of reasons, but primarily because he did not have a state-to-state organization, national message discipline, all the other things that we know go along with the successful national campaign. So the race was probably lost already, but I think this was a bit of a death knell for the campaign when not just one woman, not just two or three, but I think the number is up to 9 or 10 now, maybe more, who have come out. And that's not to say that, and I'm a believer of survivors, by the way, and so I also believe those who say they were victimized by Bill Clinton. But Bill Clinton's name isn't on the ballot. His wife is running for president. Just as I say that, you know, I believe the women who come forward in Trump's case. You know, I don't want to say that there is some difference ideologically. I don't want to say, you know, because I have to be a liberal, I have to be a conservative, I don't believe this woman or that woman based on my ideology. I have to be one of those people who believes them all, and I always have. And maybe that's because of, you know, where I've come from and what I went through, maybe.
Yeah.
But in Trump's case, I think it effectively ends the campaign. And I think you have heard him say as much over the last few days, that he believes that all of this is a part of the rigging of the system, that the elites have come together, the news networks have come together against him in one big plot to keep him out of the White House. And so I think there's some recognition on his part that this thing is over.
You have any concerns about November 9th and what happens then if he loses?
You know, I do in some ways. You know, I hear about what has happened is this. Trump has created an undeniable movement of people behind a certain number of causes, whether it be immigration or whether it be, you know, law and order support for our law enforcement officers. He has really pulled together a coalesced a group of folks together behind this movement. Some people say it's smaller or larger than others, but it is a movement that will live on even if he loses. Now, what it will become is another story altogether. If you recall, Bernie Sanders also had a bit of a movement. And when he was defeated, you know, that movement went on to do some other things. Well, it'll be interesting to see what Trump's supporters move on to do. Will they put up more school board candidates? Will they put up people for city council or for mayor or for governors? Will they be emboldened by his run enough to invest in other political candidates? And what will that do to our discourse? Will it continue to coarsen it, as we've seen, you know, really over the last 18 months? I think so. I don't think there's a point of turning back in terms of, you know, how we look at where the line for decency is in our public discourse. I don't think there's a turning back. I think we have forever moved it, and I think in the wrong direction.
Journalist, author, and public policy analyst Goldie Taylor. She's part of a St. Louis Speaker Series panel on racism in America tonight at 8 at Powell Hall. More information on that is available at stlpublicradio.org/STL on air. This is St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Thanks for listening.